I'm sure, in this room, in rural Ireland in the 80s and 90s, radio was the source of discovery, especially those late-night programmes that introduced me to all types of new and unusual music, and I've been obsessed with both media since. I suppose music and radio have been bedfellows pretty much since the arrival of broadcasting. On Christmas Eve 1906, as the broadcast historians in this room should know, the inventor Reginald Fessenden did what was widely considered to be the first ever audio broadcast. And as part of that broadcast, he played O Holy Night on his violin. So we can see from the start that kind of interlinking of music. Closer to home, as we're going to hear in a few minutes, the launch night of 2RN a century ago featured the pianist Dina Copeman. It also had music from the Army Band and had traditional Irish singing. So again, there was this sense that from the very start it was kind of bridging the gap between the national and the global. The early years of radio, I suppose, primarily relied on in-studio performances. I suppose it was with the widespread adoption of recorded music that some would argue led to maybe a marriage of convenience between the radio and music industries. Many of them were already interlinked through their ownership models. For the record companies, it provided, and it still does, an outlet for promoting their artists. For the radio station, it fills airtime quite cheaply in comparison to other modes of broadcasting. And I suppose if you put on something like Stairway to Heaven or Marquee Moon or Hotel California, it also allows presenters the opportunity to use the bathroom. Radio, as we all know, is something we can combine with other activities, commuting, exercising, working and so on. And this is particularly the case with music radio, but that shouldn't suggest that music on the radio is somewhat disposable or throwaway. Music is still a central part of the everyday listening experience. Indeed, I teach students, and they tend to be in their late teens and early 20s, and their relationship with radio is still very much based on how they use it to access music. Perhaps that's something that's under threat now through the arrival of various streaming platforms, and that's one of the things we'll be discussing later on. But before that, the esteemed panel that's lined up here will give us their insights into 100 years of music on the airwaves. You know, when you combine academics and radio folk, two categories of people that are very shy about talking, we should easily squeeze all that into 1 hour. We're going to look at the role and responsibilities maybe of radio in protecting and promoting Irish music culture and new talent. We're going to get maybe some personal perspectives of their time on air and behind the scenes, and much more as we discuss everything from traditional to popular music and everything in between. We'll see what we can get through, and hopefully we'll get a few questions in at the end as well, so you can pick your brain. So I'm going to try and whiz through all these little bios of the crew here, and I'll go through them alphabetically. So first here with Peter Brown, who worked with RTÉ Radio for over 40 years across their four flagship stations, but primarily with Radio 1. As a senior producer and commissioning editor of music programmes for that station, he dealt with all types of specialist and mainstream music programmes. He's also a musician, he's got a master's in music performance, and his dissertation explored the connection between the early years of radio and traditional music in Ireland. Again, something we'll circle back to in a moment. The next is 1987, John Creedon joined RTÉ Radio 1 through a public competition, and he's since won a number of awards, Jacobs, PPI, IMRO awards for his work at RTÉ. He spent 13 years in Dublin presenting Rising Time, and as a summer replacement for Gabe Byrne, he returned to Cork, where he currently produces and presents the John Creedon Show. John, if I read your entire bio, we mightn't be finished by the time you're on air tonight. But he's done books, TV, two-time chart topper with his character Terence.
My past talks to me.
Most importantly, he was the Cork Person of the Year 2022, which, if you're from Cork, is makes you the most important person in Ireland. Recently, he was honoured with a special IMRO Award for his contribution to Irish music. In October, he was voted the IMRO Presenter of the Year, and in November, he was awarded an Honorary Doctorate of Arts here from UCC. He also has a diploma in Regional Studies from UCC here as well. And next year, which I think might be this year, we expect to see a new series of Creedence Musical Atlas on RTÉ One Television, and we continue to look forward to his eclectic music selection every weeknight on RTÉ Radio 1. Over to Farsight, Nessa McGann. Her broadcasting career began here in UCC in 1998 on student radio. She went on to work in the newsroom and in features at RTÉ Cork before spending 7 years managing the Limerick student radio station Wired FM, where she put up with quite a lot of bothersome students, including myself. She was the first programme manager of Spin South West from its inception in 2007 up until 2020. Where she launched 1,000 music presenters' careers. We're not too sure about the verification of that particular number. Since then, Nessa set up McGann Media, where she focused on funding talent and training projects, including running the largest independent radio station climate action program initiative called Ars Protect. She also works for the Scandinavian public broadcaster NGO Radio Days and leads the Radio Days Asia event, which she said, if you want discounted tickets to go to Jakarta, you talk to her. I might have sold that a bit too much. Padraig O'Mahon is Professor of Modern Irish here at UCC, which covers everything from the 12th to the 21st century. Amongst his interests is the reflection of Irish tradition in various media over the centuries, primarily manuscript and print, but also in art illustration and digital media of the modern age. He currently directs a project based in Knocknaheeny, which, among other things, uses rap music in the Irish language as a facilitator for education, personal development and social inclusion. And one of his interests, and kind of the reason we were going to start with you, Padraig, is in the collection and publishing of songs by Seamus Clondillon, who was the first director of 2RN, and that's where we're going to start tonight. So maybe I'm going to walk over here. But Padraig, you were saying, in terms of that opening night of 2RN, we've lots of different types of music, but one of them is the first ever, as director of broadcasting at the station, Seamus Clondillon himself singing on the station. And how important, I suppose, was it that we have a figure like Clondillon steeped in kind of Irish tradition and music as that first director?
Yeah, thanks, Ciarán. There's an awful lot going on in that first night. At the launch of 2RN, it's like a snapshot of almost of a manifesto, as people would imagine and hope that the radio would develop over the coming decades. But it's also a snapshot of the time, and that's the very interesting thing. Seamus Clondillon, the first director, he wasn't the first choice candidate, but they went with him eventually because of his civil service experience. Worked in the Department of Health, and he worked in the Department of Agriculture, which was very important. He also happened to be an Irish speaker, a singer and a pianist, a linguist. He spoke in quite a number of languages. So he ticked so many boxes, but primarily I think it was his experience as a civil servant that ensured that the government, when Richard Dalmhnaill Cathy and Cosgrave would be happy with him and comfortable with somebody like him being director of the station. Now, the director of music was Vincent O'Brien, as you know, who was the leader of the Palestrina Choir. And in those two figures, I think we can trace the programme for the night itself. There was an amount of classical music, of music played by the Army Number One Band, but also solo performers playing what they called Irish airs. But there was traditional music in the two singers, Clondillon himself and his wife, Máire Ní Anagáin, and also the pipers, James Innes and Liam Andrews played. So it was an absolutely extraordinary sort of spread of music. And nevertheless, in that you have the kernel of what I think the aspiration for the studio was at for the station was at the time. It's very interesting to see the man who appointed or who was on the panel for the appointment of Clondillon as John Rees, who was head of the BBC, which was only a couple of years earlier than that, sending in a message of goodwill on the night and saying that he hoped that this would see the development of a station that would be a forum for expression of the Celtic culture. And that's very interesting because, you know, from somebody from the outside, he was a Scot, of course, from the outside, in a sense mirroring what perhaps was in the mind of the people who set up the station, that is, that it would be something that would have a unique identity. And because if you look at the BBC, when it was launched, there's near a trace of what's called folk music or sort of indigenous music, other than indigenous classical music to England. But here was an extraordinary thing, a sort of a marriage, if you like, or a free association between classical music and Irish music and song Oscailge. So there is a dynamic there from the very beginning, and Seamus Clendinnen is driving it. And he even had to argue a couple of months in the lead up to the 1st of January 26th. He had a bit of an argument with the man who was in charge of the Army Number 1 band, and that was Friedrich Brasse, a very interesting man. He was headhunted by Richard Mulcahy to set up the Army band for the Free State. He'd been a prominent Army musician in the German Army during the First World War, and Mulcahy sort of swung the deal by offering him a commission in the Irish Army, so he came in at the rank of colonel. So Colonel Fritz Brasse had no experience of folk music, had no concept of someone playing by ear on their own instruments beside the fire at home, and Clendinnen had to sort of mark his card from him on that when he gave expression to that in the lead up to the night, and that was very important. So we have to thank Seamus Clendinnen, I think, for in the first instance for that, for insisting on, even though he wasn't the director of music, he was the director of the station, but for insisting on this on this confection that appeared on the program that night. Fritz Brasse, of course, went on to, and we don't know what to be introducing this, but he was a very prominent in the Ausland organization, the Nazi he was a member of the Nazis in Ireland, if you like, of which Adolf Marr is usually the one cited, the director of the National Museum. But eventually the Irish Army had to rope him in and say, you're either one or the other, you can't be both. But very interesting in the historical context of the time, and trying not to be judgmental about it at all. So Seamus Clendinnen is in the mix here. He's laying out with Vincent O'Brien, he's laying out the programme for the night. And this, I think, was the vision musically for what they hoped to develop over the years. And in many respects, That's what happened. Of course, things change and your programming changes and you have to include the spoken word and so forth. But nevertheless, as it worked out, I think it was a fairly prophetic program for that evening. And I should say that Clendinnen himself was responsible for inviting Douglas Hyde to make the opening remarks. And if one looks at the opening remarks, Oscailge, he spoke in Irish, you can get translations of it, but Hyde might not have known what he was supposed to do, but he was emphasising the language all the way. He saw Radio 2RN as a vehicle for the revival of the language, for as he saw it at the time, and for hammering it home, really, because he firmly believed that this was going to happen in his lifetime, and that 2RN was going to be one of the vehicles for that. So there was no mention of music in his address, no mention of anything else, but his talk, and he's actually repeating something he had said 30 years previously in a very famous public lecture that he gave about de-anglicising Ireland. He saw 2RN as a way of de-anglicising Irish culture. So an awful lot going on that night.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And Peter, that might tally with some of the research that you kind of conducted as well. I mean, we're in the early years of independence, and there's this sense of trying to, I suppose, create or maybe reclaim a national identity. So kind of, you know, what level of seriousness is attached to traditional Irish music during this period? Or what's the kind of relationship between traditional music and radio in the first couple of decades, maybe, of Irish radio?
Yeah, it's interesting that first night that the program is, when you look at the music that's on it, it's Irish music, but it's really the sort of Edwardian kind of salon music of the day, pianos, tenors, contraltos, mezzos. The only item on that night that would sort of be accepted as traditional music nowadays was Seamus Ennison, Billy Andrews, the piper. The rest of it was just sort of kind of Victorian, Edwardian, but songs in Irish, like what Clendinnen himself was doing. I think, for me, just incidentally, I think he was a heroic kind of figure, because, you know, he gets the job The government doesn't really want this thing in the first place. That seems to be plain enough. They wanted then to be a commercial station. That didn't happen. Then they took it on. They gave it to the Department of Posts and Telegraphs. They didn't particularly want it either. They didn't see it as part of their business. But because of their engineering expertise, and they did have that, they put it on air. And then apparently at the time, understandably, the Department of Finance didn't want anything at all that cost money. And there are stories about trying to get money for a bottle of sherry for people, and this, I just think that he lasted 6 years doing that, and to bring it on air with such low levels of, no ability to record, very little money, and when you look at the history of most directors of radio since then, lasted about 6 or 7 years. The only one I see that went on longer than that was Roberto Farrakhan. There is one thing about Clandillon, it's just kind of funny. He apparently early on in the time of Radio Éireann, a young Scottish inventor came to him and wanted to give a radio talk about his new invention. Clandillon more or less said, we won't be having that, and offered him 5 minutes at the end of the night, which your man refused. But of course, the man was John Logie Baird, who invented television, so he didn't see everyone. The other thing just about him is that his job application is down there in the frame, and it's worth taking a look at. But one of the things you see in it is one of the questions you ask, your service in the National Army. And I would say 2.5 years after the Civil War, if you couldn't supply a satisfactory answer to that, you probably weren't going to go much further. And when you look at the history of broadcasting radio, that wasn't the last time when politics sort of came into what directors would be there or what they might be doing. You can chart the history of that yourselves. In regards to traditional music and radio, I'm fascinated. I have a romantic sense about all this, and it's funny. You have two things: radio and traditional music, and they both could have separate existences. You could have radio without a note of traditional music, you could have traditional music without any radio, but yet, when you look at them, they're so closely intertwined and interactive, and yet developing all the time. Like, in traditional music, at the time it came on the air, there was just solos, duets, trios, that sort of thing. And that's what they had. Then the Cayley Band, they really kind of pushed the Cayley Band. Vincent O'Brien, apparently, for some reason, just liked this idea, and it had better reach over the transmission system. Then the mobile recording unit, the 1947 thing, that was able to go around the country and made some fantastic acetate recordings of music. Then Ciarán McMahon, when he got tape recording and there was rural electrification, that sort of changed the scene in a big way for the work he was doing going around the country. Sean O'Riordan, who lectured in this parish, was really important, and he started his band, Ceoltóirí Chualainn, and they lasted through all the decade of 1960. And that wasn't a performing band. They didn't do gigs. They did a few, the famous one, the Gaiety and so forth, but basically it was sustained by money, maybe not much, from Radio Éireann, and that, from that grew the Chieftain. So, you can give O'Riordan, and you can give Radio Éireann a lot of credit for where that went. Likewise, the 70s, like Planxty and the Bothy Band and all that, the programme The Long Note was right on top of that, and Tony McMahon, I think, was central to a lot of those developments in the case of the Bothy Band. And even going forward, a lot of you will know the Brendan Voyage, which is the sort of orchestral suite that has the pipes and the orchestra. That was originally a commission by Harry Bradshaw, had a programme called An Dreathad Beo, The Living Bridge, and he would want new Irish composers, musicians to do something new. So he met Sean Davey and said, what can we do something here? And Sean said, well, I'm reading this book by an explorer, Tim Severin, and it's quite interesting. So they come up with the idea they would do a documentary about it, where Tim Severin would read passages from the Brendan Voyage, and Sean would write incidental or orchestral music to go with it. And from that was born the Brendan Voyage, which a lot of people know nowadays. So that's really, an example of the way the two things were closely intertwined. So, as I say, it's a pet subject of mine. I'm in love with the whole idea of it.
Okay, excellent. John, as I said at the outset, it's almost 40 years since you started working in RTE. I know you.
I was 12.
I was going to say you maybe just made your communion or something, yeah. But you aged yourself further there. When you were kind of getting into radio and listening to radio, was it primarily in Ireland? Was it stuff like traditional music or this kind of wider thing that we call popular music? Was that on the airwaves? Is that what attracted you?
Yeah, well, listening to Fáil and Peter there, I think Seamus Clandillon would probably be quite happy with a lot of the developments, because One thing is for sure, things will constantly change. And over the years, though, I think, and that's very true about even the BBC, by their own admission, folk music was never part of the mainstream. Whereas it was always part of the mainstream on RT Radio 1, and indeed on local radio, particularly Clare, Highland, and a few other stations, where it's a living traditional music. So that kind of evolved. It went on down the same road. O'Riordan, of course, was commissioned. A man who served his time here as well, Mihála Sulawin, I remember him telling me that he had musicians who were all classically trained, and they were in the music department. He said, but there was fellas going past with Illum pipes on their way down to Ag Science or whatever it was, and they had nothing at all to do with the music department. And he set up that special course to kind of to draw from the tradition into the mainstream and into class. And it goes on today, the RT Concert Orchestra with Zoe Conway would be another fine example. And at this stage, increasingly, there are many, many, many strands to the weave that is Irishness. And I feel they're being accommodated. I see Tola McKay working. She was born in Nigeria, grew up in Offaly, working with the Concert Orchestra. There's I was even thinking earlier on, I know nothing about algorithms or AI or anything. I'm sorry, I leave it to heart. I haven't a clue about the science of the business I'm in at all. I said this to Patricia recently. I said, I'm more kind of a hunches guy. And she said, that's okay. Hunches are okay too. But it seems to me that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So just as audiences are becoming maybe polarized or they're finding their own tribe and they're entering an echo chamber and it goes on, equally, I think there's an opening out. I find certainly in terms of the music I play, there's a ready appetite for it. You know, whether it be from different parts of the world, different eras. Just during the week there, I played some Woody Guthrie and backed that up with a song by Leo Kottke. And it's the number of young people that are contacting me, or even the day we were up here for the doctorate, it was the same thing. It was like Marvin Gaye will never go away. So it is constantly moving and changing, but I'd like to think that the silos are coming down. In many ways, they're coming down. Certainly in terms of our audience. I remember someone giving out about Radley na Gaeltachta once. This was over in Connemara, and they said, oh, a kind as Gaeilge, fui Gaeilge, talking in Irish about Irish, right? So I expect when RT or 2RN began, it was by the Irish, for the Irish. My audience is fairly global, and that's true of all the local radio stations as well. With internet, if you're playing a certain brand of hip-hop or you're playing non-stop reggae, you will find an audience. So I think we're back to broadcasting as well as the podcasting. So I have seen the change quite a bit over the years, yeah.
Brilliant. Nessa, you've worked in distinctly different strands of radio in Ireland, public service, community, commercial, and in all of them, music has been part and parcel of that. Why do you think it's still so important to radio? We've been talking about all these connections between music and radio. Why?
Because I think radio is part of what feeds our humanity, and I don't think that it matters whether the music that you listen to is coming from a commercial or a state broadcaster, if that's the music you're into. And I think it's something that unites us more often than not. It's strange and quite unusual to find someone who doesn't listen to any music or is not interested in music or doesn't like music. And I think that the ability to access music, new music, old music, choral music, reggae music, as John said, we have that ability now more than ever. And the, perhaps you could call them curators or you could call them gatekeepers, but those barriers aren't there anymore because music is discoverable now. But I think for music on the radio, I think that having someone who loves the music they play and who's knowledgeable about the music they play and who's passionate about the music they play adds another layer of meaning to hearing that music, whether you're hearing it for the first time or rediscovering it. And that's why I think it's important across the board for most radio stations. Obviously, there are some talk-focused, but I think across the board, Irish people in music are pretty synonymous.
And maybe, Peter, to go back to you, Ness is talking about that passion that comes from presenters. And as you said, you've worked on numerous programs in RTE as a producer over the years. Was that something that you were always looking for in a presenter, this sense that they have a passion about the music they're going to be talking about and presenting to their audience?
Like, probably not consciously at the time, but I understand it now. I'm kind of very heartened by what John says, you know, that people will always seek out what's sort of humanly created. I don't know if any of you have heard of Sienna Rose, have you? You'll be interested in it. I listened this morning on the way down the train. There's a podcast, a BBC one, by a guy called Amal Rajan, and he just interviewed the fellow who is the person who's in charge of the Grammy Award, so he must know something about this. And they mentioned Sienna Rose. Now, Sienna Rose is an artist. You can download her. She's 5 million downloads. She's this and that. There's only a slight problem. She doesn't exist. It's an AI creation. So I listened to her and I said, what is this like? Now, because I knew what they'd been saying, I was actually revolted by it. But I was asking myself the question, if I just heard this in a sort of an offhand way, would I actually think this is really good music or something? And it kind of worried me. But then I just fell to thinking that it'll be a long time before you'll create Bruce Springsteen or you'll create something that's as unique as that. So it's not my fear. He did say that AI would be used for a lot of functional music. Okay, and I think I understand what that is. But every presenter, I think, every producer has their own sort of internal algorithm for when you're making a program. I mean, John's unlikely to play a half an hour of Tibetan nose flute music.
You might be giving him an idea there now, or
a solo wind pipe. And I remember when I was doing live music programs, I used to call them, you had about 10 or 12 variables, like instrumentals or crooners, an Irish ballad, the Great American Songbook, melodic pop, maybe something at the time way out like Van Morrison or that, you know. So you had your own rules. Everyone has their own rules. But it's a different thing for me to think that there's a machine or there's some non-human entity kind of collecting data and then sending choices in people's direction that they're going to follow. And then the people who are listening will say, oh, I love this, and it becomes some sort of strange listening kind of circle. So I'd be heartened to think that people will be able to discover new music, but I just hope that they can do it and that they find their way through a sort of a machine-created forest of stuff that's already laid out for them that they're going to follow, you know?
Yeah, I mean, whatever happened to surprise me? You know, it's like you can feed in the information and once the algorithm has you locked onto you, well, then that's what you'll be fed, secularis, secularum. What about surprising me? And that, I suppose, is one of the joys of curated programs, and we have a policy of curated programs. And that's risky in ways, I suppose, you might think, in the day when everybody wants to do the science, do the mathematics of it, and see what works and what works, what's the optimum at all times. Sometimes, just to be surprised is a wonderful thing, you know? And so that's at least one thing I'd like to think, that on RT Radio 1 and on other stations where you have curated programs, that you can be pleasantly surprised, or you can have your ears open to something brand new, you know?
And John, like your program, obviously it's a nighttime program now, and you're on five nights a week, and you could be playing 30 minutes of Tibetan nose flute or whatever it was tonight.
That's tomorrow night, probably.
Tomorrow night, okay, fair enough. Tonight's locked in. I said at the outset my initial relationship with radio was around that late night listening and that kind of, I suppose, and we've had the word intimacy used a lot today, but yeah. I found that kind of that intimate experience of, you know, listening to presenters and they're presenting their tastes. And, you know, you've presented across the board. What do you see as the kind of key difference as, you know, that idea of doing that nighttime show, nighttime presenting?
Yeah, over the years, I've been lucky enough to, I've kind of rocked around the clock, so to speak. Everything from early mornings to late nights. I did 6 years at lunchtime. Over the years then, I would have worked on the Gayburn, well, with Gayburn and Jerry Ryan, served my time there as well. All of it, though, was kind of stream of consciousness stuff. Hmm. Yeah, I can write a script and deliver a script, but for the most part, it was seat of the pants. And that's where the magic happens. That's where the crack is. You can write that down then and perform it later if you so wish, but it's that stream of consciousness stuff where people, like, I would like to think I come from the same school as Donal Co-Dooling and Jimmy McGee and little boys like that, people who never grew up. So that's kind of where the daytime thing was for me. It was always in and around comedy, it was mischief, it was loud, because you have to be heard, you've got to cut through, I guess, on daytime radio. You're battling with the traffic and whatever else people are dealing with. I find now, and this wasn't thought out, but what kind of happened to me is that I realise it's that time of evening when people are taking stock, they're doing the dishes or not, as the case may be, maybe driving home from work after having a barney with someone and wishing they hadn't. It's a great opportunity to listen to Bob Dylan or, you know, or something that is more reflective. So I think that would be my general leaning. But again, I'm not going to get overly mathematical about it. That for me would be the big difference. Daytime, you've got to cut through. You've got to be heard. You've got to have the exclamation marks in there. Whereas come evening time, there can be more question marks than exclamation marks. And especially at times like this, not unlike anybody else, I guess I'm feeling the stresses of it all too. And so when you roll out a kind of a comfort place like that in the evening, I think it's probably good for people's health. Good for my mental health anyway, that's for sure. Yeah.
Nessa, I suppose considering we have a presenter beside us and many more in the room probably, what do you think maybe makes a good music presenter? Maybe what is it that Irish music presenters do particularly well and maybe not do so well, if you want to go that far?
Well, I don't know. You're not paying me enough, I think, to tell you what they don't do well.
Just trying to get the thing going.
I suppose there's a couple of different types of presenters. Mm. And obviously, John Creedon is an expert in what he does and is a very knowledgeable music creator and brings his own sense and his own choice to the air. But there's a huge amount of music presenters on air who don't choose their own music across 2FM, I would say, and also across the independent radio sector. And they're still really good at what they do. And most of them, I think, if not all of them, love music. They mightn't love every single song they play. They might be sick of one or two songs in particular that are on high rotation. But they bring passion and they bring energy and they bring a certain amount of knowledge. And they do, I suppose, what John is talking about, which is understand where their audience is at that particular point in the day and connect with them on a human level. And I think that's what a good presenter does. Whether they do it like Steve Kay on Spin 1038 in 10 seconds, I've heard him do some amazing stuff that has made me laugh. And I've heard other presenters doing a 3-minute link that has made me cry, and not in a good way, because it's gone on for 2 minutes and 30 seconds too long, in my opinion. So I think that there's a wide variety of great presenters across the board in Ireland, and I think we're natural storytellers. And whether it's telling the story of how you got up or how you got to work or something that happened, or whether it's telling someone else's story in terms of listener engagement, or whether it's telling the story of the song or the artist or the news of the day, I think Irish people have a great ability to tell a story well. They also have a huge ability to tell a story really badly and go on for far too long. So that's probably all I'll say on that one.
Great. Okay. I'm conscious that all of us here are, I'm going to be polite and say none of us are under 40. Us talking about maybe giving a voice to younger people it might be questionable in a sense. But maybe, Padraig, I'm thinking to that rap project in Notting Hill that you're working in, and your kind of interaction with young people. Do you think, you know, music is still music under, or the radio is still important in that mediation of music for youth that you work with?
Absolutely, I think, yeah. And just to explain to the audience, I don't look like a rapper. But I'm not a rapper.
If you first think you're a rapper, it'd be fantastic.
You can double your
best. But what? What we've realised working with the Terence McSweeney in Notting Hill is that present in the north side of Cork City is something that we in sort of the Irish language business, if that's the word for it, have been looking for so long, and that is something to hang Gaeilge on that doesn't involve rowing a curragh or making a cow. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We have a frame of reference through the cabin crew, through the rap culture, if you want to call it that, gifted to us,
yeah.
And made for Gaeilge, made for the school children that we work with. we don't have to talk about, you know, the things that I love myself, the autobiographies and so forth, the O'Sullivan and so forth from the 18th century. We don't have to refer to that at all. We can use Irish in the context of rap music, and suddenly it's like, and it was like, and it is like, it's like throwing a switch. And suddenly people will think Irish is all about the Taoiseach Ginnadach or the Mócanéil, which if I had my way, I would ban. Because it's a big turn off. But here we have, something that is of immediate relevance to the school children. And that's why we're involved in this. And certainly the element, the audio element in that, the listening of it, it's almost like they have radios inside in their ears, inside in their heads. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't, I mean, you won't believe this, but rap is, has a sort of a, there's a psychology to it that is benign and beneficial, in that it somehow or other, and Rap Os Gaeilge works just like what Rap Os Biarla, somehow or other it encourages the children to address subject matter that they wouldn't normally talk about. Mm-hmm. And as a musical, as a vehicle for that, and as a target and as a point of reference for that, the Irish language, which gives it an edge, that has been a revelation. It's not as if I thought about it. This is something that happened and developed organically, and I said, "Japers, you know, this is it." Okay. So in the context then of modern of rap music and modern culture, the audio is there's the video, but there's the audio as well, and it seems to me that they start thinking in rap, they're listening to it, it infects them in a positive sense, and we're tapping in on that, we're tapping into that. And Gaeilge is suddenly not this mass of declensions and conjugations, but it's actually something that is of huge relevance to the children.
I just want to jump in and probably give a big shout out to Stevie G on Red FM, who's done a lot of work with The Cabin and plays an awful lot of new Irish music. And first generation Irish people who live in Cork, young people especially. But also to say that I work a lot. I'm not under 40 anymore, God love us. But I work a lot with young people, people under the age of 25. I work a lot with Learning Waves. And we do a lot of introduction to broadcasting courses for people who want to get into the industry, but who haven't maybe done a degree in communications or journalism. And I also work in Europe with Radio Days Europe with young people from across the industry, from across all the countries in Europe, to train them and introduce them to the industry. And there is a great love for music radio with younger people, and there is a great interest in it. But it's not the only thing they listen to, and it's not the only way they do discover. Mm-hmm. And I know John has kind of referenced the algorithm and, you know, the dark science or whatever. But that's the world we live in now, you know, it's just a fact of life. But there is still a passion or a grow for people, to young people, to be involved. And the idea of sharing your music and getting to do that, it still seems like it's not a real job.
And just on that very subject, I mean, we're very conscious of that as well. I know I speak for probably all presenters. You're constantly looking for something new, something fresh. And take, for example, Khaki Kid. We did a piece with him for the new series of Creedence Musical Atlas. But he said to me, I love your show. And I said, do you listen to my show? And he said, I do, yeah. And one of the reasons he told me is because we have a recommends list. So it's not a hard and fast rule. It's just simply for your consideration. And we skew that down. We were always looking for new young artists, and all the other presenters and producers can feed into it, and this is produced every week. It's also put up on its online and on Spotify and everything else. So through that, I'm pleasantly surprised to see that music programs on RT Radio 1 particularly are sucking in new listeners as well, and they're finding each other on playlist, and you kind of say, right. And also, I'd have to say, and I'm sure most of the music presenters here, Peter and all the rest, Ken, will say, you look around you at what's new in Ireland, not what's brand new in Ireland, what's new in Ireland at the moment, and you look at bands like Amble and Kingfisher, you can play them for your granny and granddad, there's no problem. The stuff is very accessible at the moment as well. There were times, I look at punk, for example, and that's like mid-70s, so your average punk fan is probably in their 70s now. An awful lot of people would find that, or 60s anyway, a lot of people find that very discordant. It's very hard to listen to. It's not hard to listen to Amble, not hard to listen to Kingfisher, not hard to listen to the aforementioned Tolu McKay and others like that. So that's one of the joys, is that the music that's coming available is not only top-notch on the global stage, but is actually very accessible. You won't lose your older audience by playing some of the new acts coming in. That makes it much easier, whereas when punk happened, it was very difficult to try and hold Mam and Dad if you were playing the Clash or whatever, you know.
I suppose, John, and anyone else who wants to pick up on it, I suppose you're talking about the accessibility, but maybe some music isn't as readily accessible in terms of how we listen to it. And I think of, in terms of RTE itself and the closure of the stations Pulse and 2XM that dealt with that kind of specialist music, they didn't close in before the end of the year. And maybe, and anyone who wants to jump in here, but maybe the responsibilities of our public service broadcaster to kind of represent the kind of diversity of the Irish music fabric, which is, I know it's quite a difficult thing to do, but kind of what responsibilities are there?
When I was running Spin, I was convinced that I was the first person to play Stormzy on daytime. I was wrong. 2XFM played it first in the park, and like there are great presenters and really knowledgeable music people and some amazing music that's super niche being played on those stations. So it is a shame to see them go, but it's always a shame to see stations amalgamate, specialist shows get dropped. It's the first thing to go. It's cheap. It's easy. You know. It is a shame, and you know there are other avenues now for people to listen to music, but I would say that public service wise there's a huge opportunity to do more with 2FM. Sorry, Patricia. But I feel like as a citizen and as somebody who loves radio, I think that it's underwhelming what it can do, and I have to say, you know, commercial radio could do better as well. It could do a hell of a lot better, and it's not doing it because it's not mass appeal, so it's not going to bring you the same advertising bucks. So I think there is a kind of a moral compass here that we need to find if we're going to support our artists properly and our presenters properly.
Okay. Yeah. There was always a sort of a debate as to whether you should have programmes that were defined by genre, like traditional music, like world music, like jazz and those, or whether you incorporate that music into general programs. I was always in favour of the former one there, but I appreciate the cost money in that. Just a point about traditional music, and maybe jazz, but they're sort of non-algorithmic because truly there's no money in them. Like, traditional music is the thing which is not intermediated. Most of the traditional music that goes on is played person to person, or at the Willie Clancy Summer School or that, or there's a certain amount of it on. I mean, Radio Negrete does a lot of it, but there's no point in having algorithms, or it's not going to get there. I think orchestral music, and it's important to mention the orchestras, all that they did down the year, but it's equally, the repertoire is defined, and so there's not much you're going to do to fashion taste about that. Jazz is fairly anarchic, I would say, I don't know, can you do much in terms of fashioning people's taste? But I was always in favour of, the term specialist didn't appeal to me, but just music which was for people who like a particular genre. Like, someone mentioned Sandy Hirst. Hiram this morning mentioned Sandy Hirst. She was a fantastic country presenter. She really knew her stuff, and that was the sort of an oasis that people went to late on a Saturday night, okay, but still it had tremendous value for those people, and I think they felt sort of loved by her. They had a great relationship with her, you know. So there's a big difference between that and having a program which throws in a bit of this and a bit of that. It's like going into a restaurant and getting all your courses horsed onto the one plate or something. But it's a personal thing, and it costs money, I accept that.
Yeah, and you think, like, I mean, we started with talking traditional music at the outset. Do you think that's something that should be still very much part of the fabric of our national broadcaster, that traditional music is promoted?
I definitely think that, well, for RT, it's probably, it's something they should, I can't say should be, I hate being prescriptive, but I always am happy to imagine that they will sort of be sustaining cultural awareness in all directions, not just music, but literature as well, and those things as well. Because the other stations may not want to do that, there's reasons they can't do it, but I could see a place for RTE doing that. Not just radio, television as well. You know, there is no real traditional music program on television at the moment like there was with the Pure Drop or Come West Along the Road, those things. They're not there. I just have a sense, and I believe there's an audience there for it. I sense it's there for it. just is not there at the moment. But again, it's wider questions about whether you can afford to put those things on, etc., etc., etc. But yeah, ideally, you'd like to see them there.
If I might just kind of chip in on that one, as you say, 87 was when I went into RT Radio 1, and I would have been pitching to listeners who were on average 25 or 30 years older than me. It was like that. So I was learning more and more about Billie Holiday or about the RT Concert Orchestra or about the Symphony Orchestra or Elgar or whatever else it might have been. But what I've noticed is, as we move, so does the audience. So I'm looking out now presenting the RT Radio 1 Folk Awards, and that will be another one of, I suppose, RT's commitments to traditional music and to traditional culture. And I'm looking at the audience. Yeah, they have beards and they have woolly jumpers, but they're only 22 and 19, you know what I mean? So it keeps on regenerating. And I know there's always a push to kind of to generate new audience, and I guess we all have to. It's one of the reasons we're here. And but it keeps on changing, and I do see the walls coming down. For example, even in RT at the moment, and I'm not in strategy, so I don't know about the opening or closing of stations or dropping of programmes. I'm not involved in those conversations at all. I live on the other side of the door. But anyway, but what I have noticed as a listener, because first and foremost I'm a listener, I love radio since I was a kid, since Radio Éireann, not quite far as 2RN, but definitely Radio Éireann. In fact, I used to always think my old man had a brilliant radiogram, a huge one, in the kitchen, and he ran a wire from it all the way up the stairs by the eight sisters. So they had two dormitories kind of at the top, and he had a little church speaker, a little mahogany box that he had wired up into it, and the battle cry in the morning was always, higher than the wireless, lower than the wireless. But he had another wire then going out the back and around the Sacred Heart picture to get the best possible reception. But I remember as a kid, I used to always ask myself, why do they call it the wireless? There's wires hanging out of everything, you know? But what I have noticed is, hugely, in the last year or two, the amount of crossover. They're not walls anymore, they're hedges. They appear to be, to me as the listener, I'm hearing Jenny Green with the RT Concert Orchestra. I'm hearing, I heard Aidan Gormley from Lyric FM on RT Radio 1 yesterday. So there's that whole mix and match. 2 FM DJs are popping up all over the place on RT Radio 1, where I should be. I know. But they're coming in as contributors all the time, and it's brilliant because it's a bedding in of new people. And there was a time when, I guess, Peter and Ken and a few of us wouldn't even be allowed in this room because we were from the other side entirely. So I see those walls coming down the whole time, independent radio and RTE, sharing the same room, sharing the conference, and sharing probably, at times, a united vision. So we're all here because we love the game, you know?
Yeah, so,
just one thing very briefly, just say about those, when I'm saying about specialist programs, or if that's the term, I don't mean that they should be just preaching to the converted. I think you should all, if you have them, they should always try to be as accessible and reach as many people as possible, you know, and it's possible to do that by making them interesting. Sorry.
No, just on that question of the walls coming down and so forth, and linking it in with Seamus Clendillon back in the day, 100 years ago. I think we need to give a shout out here, especially in Cork, to Fachlo Hárlachain, who was head of music. He was assistant head of music, and then he was head of music through the 40s and into the 50s and early 60s, I think. And someone who with a big Gaelic background. His father was Padraig O'Hárlachain, author and tumult and so forth. But he was so, I suppose, he embodied this element of there being no boundaries. He would, after Michael Bowles, he was the one responsible for setting up the RT Symphony Orchestra, and for keeping it going and for staffing it and so forth. When you wouldn't expect someone with Fachlo Hárlachain's, apologies to Henry, background. Yeah. You know, there's an image of the Gaelic Oish, which is that of the conservative Blackthorn wielding, and you understand, I don't need to say anymore. When in fact, you know, I like that linear genealogy, if you like, from Clendillon to O'Hárlachain, and then into some of the people that you mentioned there, to Donachó Dooling, Ciarán MacMahona, very broad and Catholic small c in their musical tastes, and in the question of public service, you couldn't ask for better. In the legacy that they've left.
Great. Have we time for a few questions?
Two questions.
Yeah, we're going to take... I could ask these guys, these folks have a lot of questions, but I think it's about time I showed up. So maybe if we can get a couple of questions. There's a woman here.
Just we better introduce this woman here, because I
If you can give yourself a little introduction.
This is the voice of Blue is here.
Ah, yes.
I'm not going to ask this in my voice.
I didn't do it.
I was delighted to hear Patrick mention Fatna O'Hanrahan because he was my uncle. And only that Peter briefly mentioned the orchestras. I think what Radio Éireann did for classical music is really important to remember, because without Radio Éireann there wouldn't have been what was then the Light Orchestra and the Symphony Orchestra and all of the stuff that developed. That's the first thing. It also, that commitment, and Fatna was a very sophisticated man, I remember the oddest people from parts of Europe turning up in my grandmother's house in Kinsale, and you didn't know who they were, and they were all musicians that he was out recruiting. But what it did was it created an audience for classical music. People learnt about classical music through the radio. I certainly did. And then the last thing I want to say is RTÉ Lyric FM is an extraordinary creation, and I think that deserves to be saluted as well.
Yeah, hear, hear.
Absolutely.
Music station here.
Yeah. Anyone else that wants to ask a question? Everyone gone shy?
Yeah.
Oh, the man up there. And if you can briefly introduce yourself as well.
Yeah, I'm Larry Dineen from the BBC. I was at an audience thing recently. It's people from across the UK. And there were people who were just about leaving university. And none of the young people who were there were listening to the radio unless their parents had it on. They were all listening to music, but it was all streaming services. And I'm just wondering, how worried do you think we should be? And are we in danger of losing something?
Oh, gee, thanks, Ciarán.
Payback.
You're not worried about your audience, you're not really thinking properly. I think that's true for all stations at all times. Who they are, where they're listening, how long they're listening, will radio be in the car in 10 years' time? Younger people, there's no doubt about it. They are listening to podcasts, they are listening to audiobooks, and they're listening to Spotify and other kind of streaming platforms. So if your radio station isn't also available on the areas where, or in the areas where your audience is spending their time, then you're not thinking very strategically. I do think that people tend to listen to stations like RT1 and News Talk when they've got jobs and mortgages and houses and vote in elections. I think there's a little bit of fear mongering around people don't listen to radio, but I think we have to be really strategic about it, and I think that we have to mind our services, and we have to make sure that when they do listen to radio that they're getting something worth listening to. And we have to look at the news service for young people, and what is that, and where is the current affairs for young people, and how are we reflecting ourselves and our young audience in our lineup online and on air? What's our social media policy? What's our plan? What's our strategy? I'm not saying I have all the answers, but I've worked recently, I suppose, in Europe and Asia, and they're all saying the same thing, and everybody is worried, and the people that will survive are the people who are actually doing things. And if they don't work out, then you do something else, but you have to do something, you have to address it, because it's not a given anymore that FM is the go-to. It's just not.
Anyone else want to answer to that?
Well, that says it all.
No, I think that's probably our time up. Thanks very much to our panel for their thoughts. And I'm sure you can vote them all later and ask them more questions.
Thanks, John.
Well, thanks a million. If you didn't cover half the thing, that's great. No, thanks a million, folks. Oh, that's great.